Thank you very much for coming out and joining us. Thank you for caring about web standards. This talk is Money for Nothing and Specs for Free. And the beginning of this talk is kind of going to sound a little bit like Grammy's talk. Why should we care about standards? Well, if you work with any of these technologies, and I'm pretty sure if you're working on the web, you're going to be working with some of these techs are all managed by standards bodies, the specifications. So, and they've all recently had changes happen to them. So why? What are the benefits of having standards organizations look after these specifications? Well, discovery, right? Then one of the nice things about having a standards body is they have some place on the web you can go and look. I need a standard that enables me to do this. I'm trying to solve this problem. They give you a place to go and look. So there's a discovery aspect. Consistency. One of the things that standards bodies enforce is when they're creating standards, they have some kind of consistency between how they produce the different specs. So it helps to learn. And it makes sure that all aspects of writing a spec are considered: security, compatibility, performance. And there is some guarantee of consensus. It's not just one person sitting in their basement who decided, here, this is a really good idea, let's put this up, and this is how we should do it. No, people have sat down and thought about it, tried to consider scenario, all different kinds of scenarios, and tried to come up with the best solution. So you get a certain amount of confidence when basing your own work on some kind of web standard. And protection. There's legal issues when you go and reuse other people's work. And standard bodies give you a certain guarantee, a certain legal protection, or at least some kind of awareness of what the copyright, patent, licensing type of issues are with regards to that work that you are reusing. Now, as Rami mentioned, there are all kinds of standards bodies to choose from. So, like, which should I get involved with if I want to contribute towards web standards? Which one? Well, let's take a look at some of the ones. Rami's already mentioned about ECMA. They most famously manage ECMAScript. They also now manage the JSON spec. Google Dart is in there, Microsoft C Sharp, the OpenOffice XML, the XPS paper specification. There's tons of others. I just highlighted a few that we're interested in. Now, one of the reasons I asked Rami the question about how do you get involved is because one of the good things is these standards bodies are changing and becoming more open, having more open processes. It's amazing that they now have this stuff on the GitHub repo. Because traditionally, to be an ordinary member of the ECMA, it's $100,000 a year to be an ordinary member. But you know, there's certain authority that comes with that. That doesn't mean that you can't contribute and you can't get involved. But to make decision-making, you know, there's money involved. And ECMA also have the ability to have certain patents and licensing associated to the specifications that they produce. There's another big one is OASIS. OASIS have OData, SAML, the security access tokens, OpenDocument, which is the format for OpenOffice, the Microsoft Office competitor. And CAMP is an interesting one that I just bumped into. One of the problems with me writing specs like this is, writing talks like this, is I go off and look at websites and I'm like, oh, look, this is really cool. Oh, and it takes me way longer than it should because I'm discovering new things all of the time. CAMP is a specification for cloud platform providers, a standardized API that is intended for different cloud providers to be able to just provide the same API for automating the deployment of infrastructure. And then, of course, we have the W3C, one of the big people who've brought the web to where it is today. They have a guarantee that the specs that are managed by them are royalty-free. There are membership fees to become an official member of some of the working groups, but as there are GitHub repos where you can contribute, you can get involved for minimal effort. There were a few years ago where they had a little bit of difficulty staying relevant with certain specifications, and we had some problems with HTML, and then there became the other WatWG working group who also decided to do HTML, but that situation is improving. But WatWG is another working group that was initially, it was a vendor consortium. They have a private invite to an authority position, but they accept contributions from everybody. They also have a very different style of writing specs, which we'll see an example of a little bit later. The standards body that I'm most familiar with, and one we're going to do a little bit more of a deep dive into, is the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force. They have been kind of responsible for the internet itself and all of the protocols, the HTTP, the URIs, SMTP, POP, DNS, all those networking type stuff. But they also do deal with application level issues, and they deal with security and all sorts of things. In fact, they have over 7,000 specs, and you can go back and read specs back from like the 70s and the 80s. It's quite an interesting dive into history. It's very much an individual type membership. It's not a corporate membership. When you want to get involved, you get involved as an individual. There's no licensing. It's just you join the mailing list and you start contributing. Now, the one thing that all of these guys, these standards bodies, have in common is they have some ceremony. And it's a barrier to entry, because at first it might seem pointless. Why do we do all this stuff? And it's a little intimidating learning all the conventions and the way they're set up. But there usually is a purpose to this ceremony. And it takes time to get used to it, but the rewards are really valuable because there is so much useful information that these standards bodies are producing, so much great work. And the IETF, as I say, is one body that I think is really worth getting into because it's great for individuals to get involved with, and you don't need a huge amount of commitment to both contribute and to get value out of it. So let's dig into some of the ceremony of the IETF and try and make it a little less scary. They have this wonderful motto that I really like. We reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code. One of the gateways to actually become a full internet standard is you must have two independently developed implementations that are interoperable based on a particular spec. It can take a while for specs to get to that status, but it's interesting that they reject voting. Well, you would think that's kind of a key part of some kind of standards body. They have a really unusual process. If you ever go to like face-to-face meetings, and I hope to go there one day to one of their face-to-face meetings, but if they're trying to make a decision, they hum and as a sign of agreement. So you get a table of people sitting around, what do we think of this? Mm-hmm, and the louder the hum, the more the agreement. It's a strange process, but apparently it works for them. It is, but it's almost an anonymous vote, right? Because it's kind of hard to, yeah. So they have a great document called the Tao of IETF, and it kind of summarizes the overall way that the IETF runs, and it's a good place to start if you want to learn more about the IETF. So within the IETF, the work gets done in working groups. And working groups are divided into areas. We've got the applications in real time. We have a general. We have internet, operations, routing, security, transport. And within these areas, there are actually hundreds of working groups. I called out just a few. They're the ones I'm more familiar with, ones that are more relevant, I think, to people building web applications. So we have HTTP Biz is a working group. They are the ones that work on the HTTP spec, the recent rewrite, and the HTTP2. We have Apps AWG, which is a horrible name, but it's basically if you're building web applications, building new media types, wanting to find new status codes or new headers, it goes in Apps AWG. Core is interesting. It's a protocol for building RESTful systems, but with reduced capabilities, capacity. It's kind of an Internet of Things version of RESTful protocols. There's quite a lot of interesting work going on in the security area. You might be familiar with the term ACME. If you've heard recently, Let's Encrypt just recently now have gone live, and you can get SSL certificates for free. Yay! They use the ACME protocol for provisioning those SSL certs. The OAuth working group are working on all kinds of things related to OAuth. Josie, if you've ever used JWT tokens, JWT tokens, they are now extending those JWT tokens to allow you to do digital signing and encryption and things like that. All sorts of interesting things going on in those working groups. But what have they done lately, right? You know, I think a lot of people look at standards bodies and go, yeah, it's just old, slow things that, you know, takes forever for anything to happen. You'd be surprised at how much work comes out of these guys. Recently, in the apps working group, we've got 7320, the URI design and ownership. It had a better name as a draft. It was called Get Off My Lawn. And it talks about not designing URI structures into specifications so that you are enforcing other people who want to implement the spec to follow your URI design. Forwarded was, we'll look into this spec a little bit more in a minute, but this is a replacement for the X-forwarded 4 specification. JSON merge patch, there's also JSON patch, JSON pointer, and Webfinger. If you're old like me, you'll probably remember the way back in the early days of the internet, there used to be a thing called a finger protocol, which you could use to find out information about a person. Well, it's made a comeback, Webfinger. The HTTP Biz working group have been working really hard. They've replaced the 2616 spec, HTTP spec, with a series that now is in 5 specs, 7231, 32, 33, 34. They didn't change the semantics of HTTP. They didn't change any behavior. It still does the same thing. They just clarified a lot of things that have caused confusion over the last 10, 15 years. And it's a much better written set of specs that gets rid of a lot of confusion about the best ways of using HTTP. And of course, we now have HTTP 2, and she's in 7540. Which came through amazingly quick. I think it's probably 18 months, 2 years for it to actually go through the whole process and go out into a full RFC, which is for a protocol that is potentially going to drive the entire web is quite an impressive timescale. Interesting one, again, one I discovered while researching for this talk, authentication info. If you are authenticating against some kind of authorization server and you're going to send it your credentials, often they'll return some information back. In OAuth 2, it returns an auth code, or it could be a token. But there's no standard way of returning that information back. Some people put it in a JSON payload. Some people put it in a parameter at the end of a redirect URL. Authentication info is a new header that says, put it in an authentication info header, and you can return back information from an authentication request. Request encoding. Another interesting one, when you're working on the web and you're retrieving content, and maybe it's large content, we want to gzip it, right? So we can send an accept header to the server that says, oh, by the way, I support gzip, so if you'd like to send it me back in a compressed format, go ahead, no problem, I can decompress that. But what this spec does, it says, oh, you can also use the accept header in the response. So if I'm sending content to a server, let's say I send a big payload and the server goes, oh, wow, look at all this content. You know what? I support gzip. It can go back to the client and say, by the way, next time you send me something, if you want, you can gzip it because I know how to ungzip it. So this is an extension to the HTTP specification that's just going to allow us to do more efficient things on the web through these standardized interaction mechanisms. Now, these are all RFCs. They have a number associated to them. It means it's gone through the working group process. There has some consensus been reached, and we've decided, yep, okay, this is good to go. We can start trying to use this and see if it works on the big, bad web. Drafts are kind of an earlier stage. This is how specs start. They start out as an internet draft. And there's some great ones. HTTP problem is in its final stages. It's a standardized response format for when you call an API and there's some kind of error and you want to include additional details. APIs keep reinventing this thing. Here's a standard way of doing it. Text/markdown. It's just a media type definition, so you can put in the content type header to say this content that's coming back is some kind of markdown. It was really interesting following the process of that media type being defined, because it was like, well, which flavor of markdown? Well, there's GitHub, there's the original Gruber one. There was all kinds of debates going on as, like, well, what does that exactly mean? And it's this kind of deep thinking and study and consensus that is really important. And it's valuable if you ever try and go and use that text markdown. Go back and dig into, find out why. Because it's all recorded. It's all out there. Why did they do things the way that they intended to do them? File URI scheme is interesting because it's not new, right? We've had file colon whack whack for years and years and years. Well, certainly in the Windows world. Problem is, there isn't a standard, consistent cross-platform story here. So this is what this draft is trying to do. It's saying, okay, we care about more than just the Windows platform. We care about all platforms. Why don't we set it up so that, let's describe what file means in all different platforms so that we can use it on the web. In HP Biz, we've got the 451 status code, which is the status code that says, you can't have this for legal reasons. You know that when you're in Canada and you go to watch Comedy Central and it goes, no, we won't deliver you that content because you're in Canada. That's a specific status code that has been added to tell the client there's a legal reason why you're not getting this content. And there's been certain groups who pushed for this to become a standard because they want to crawl the web looking for places who are not allowing certain content to be delivered for legal reasons. Key header field, if you've ever worked with content negotiation and caching and the very header, you know how painful the very header is. It doesn't work. It's not implemented well. We're trying to fix that. The key header is a spec that fixes the problems of the very header. Client hints, it's great. You hear lots of talk in web about responsive design. Client hints allows a client application to send in the request headers things like, this is my device pixel ratio. This is my width of my UI. This is my viewport width. This is the bandwidth. This is the speed of the connection that I'm on. So the server can actually deliver content to the client that is appropriate to the particular device. Alternative services. This is load balancing, but client driven. So the server can go, yeah, I got this content. You want this content? Well, you can get it from over here, or you can get it from over here. So a client can go, oh, well, this is closer. I got a faster connection here. I'll go download it from there. Some of these specs, the drafts ones, may never turn into anything. It may not pick up enough traction. But if you're not aware of these, you can't put your support behind them, and you can't, you know, what the standards bodies need is people to get involved, look at these, go, yeah, this is a really good idea, and actually do implementations of these specs. So I've talked a little bit about standards and internet draft. The overall process goes like this. It starts out as an internet draft. Anybody can write an internet draft, just put a document up on the web and say, here's my internet draft, and then submit a link to that document to the IETF and say, look, I'd like some working group to take over this, and let's discuss it, and let's turn it into something everybody can use. Now, what they would prefer is you use a certain style, certain format, and structure for those internet drafts, and there is tooling I'll talk a little bit about to help you get that kind of consistent spec, but that's basically where it starts. Anybody can do it. Then once the working group takes over, they kind of say, okay, well, what kind of document is this? Is this something that is going to one day become a worldwide internet standard, so we need to be really careful about it? Or is it, you know, is this an experimental thing that you're playing with? Is it just information? Is it best practice? Or is this something that used to happen, and we just want to record why things were the way they were at some point in time? That's what the historical style of document is. And eventually, some standards finally make it into the full internet standard. But you know what? There's lots of HTTP is still a proposed standard. HTTP2 is still a proposed standard. There's lots of standards that never actually move out of this middle phase of just being a plain RFC. So just to kind of give you an idea of this kind of consistent structure, and to try and take a lay, make it a little bit easier to read these documents. We're going to walk through an example spec and talk about the different parts of it. I'm using the example of the forwarded HP extension, which is the replacement for X forwarded 4. And one of the values of actually having this as a spec is if you actually try and go looking for, okay, how do I use X forwarded 4? Where's the authoritative place to find out the information about that? Who created it? What's the revision history of it? What is it like? Where do I go looking? I don't have that discovery spot. I mean, Wikipedia basically ends up being the starting point for people, and that has its pros and cons when it comes to defining standards for the web. So by moving it into an IETF specification, first of all, we get to get rid of the X dash in front of it because that. Nothing was ever supposed to go out. No headers, no media types were ever supposed to make it out into the wild with X dash in front of them. It was supposed to be experimental. It doesn't mean extension. There's actually an RFC telling you not to use X dash anymore. Unfortunately, it's out there, and it's very hard to take things back from the web once they go out. So forwarded, we have an RFC number at 7239. It's indicated as a proposed standard because there has been consensus reached in a working group. Another thing I discovered, even that blue bar, it actually means something at the top. If you click on it, you get this little thing that drops down and tells you, oh, this is the status of this particular spec. So the blue means it's a proposed standard. So the first thing you'll find in every IETF spec is the abstract. And this kind of sets the stage as to what is this spec for? In a very short, you know, I can read this in 2 minutes, what the purpose of it. And the purpose of this is we're going to define a new HTTP extension header field, or a new HTTP header field. And the next section is status of the memo. So it's like, where are we up to in the development of this spec, right? Well, yeah, it's on the standards track, it's proposed status, it represents consensus, and the one thing that is important is when you take an internet draft and you submit it to the IETF, you're giving it to that, you're assigning them a license for being able to, an irrevocable license to that. We'll see that in a second, actually. So I'm skipping over, the forwarded was a proposed standard. If it's an internet draft, the status says something different. It says it's a working document, and it's only valid for up to 6 months. It means it has to keep being refreshed, or it will basically expire, and then nobody's supposed to, we're not working on it anymore, we're done, right? And if it's just a draft, we're not supposed to reference it from any other specs. So I have a question. Anybody use JSON schema? We got one. I'm sure lots of people online are saying that they use JSON schema. It expired in 2013, okay? So the problem is being part of these bodies, it's a volunteer process. It takes people just to do it. And people are saying, well, we did this. It's good. We're working with it. I'm too busy to actually push this through, to go through the rest of the ceremony to turn it into a full proposed standard. But in the meanwhile, it means that somebody can't reference it. Another example, if people are using HAL, right? That expired just recently. This is written by a friend of mine, Mike Kelly, right? He's a young guy, brilliant, smart guy from England. And he's like, well, you know, why do I need to? Like, I've written it. People are using it. Amazon are using it in their API, but it's expired. But again, the problem is if somebody now wants to refer to this in one of their specs, they're not going to be allowed to by the IETF because it's not draft. And at that point, somebody will go, Mike, please, can we push it through the rest? And it'll go through the rest of the way because there are enough implementations out there that are interoperable, so it meets the criteria. But I wanted to point out, you know, Mike, he's not some like research scientist hiding in some big enterprise somewhere. It's not a team of people. It was one person who had a good idea, and he decided, oh, let's write it up as a spec. And it's been used by a lot of companies now. So going back to our forwarded spec, we have the copyright notice. And as I mentioned, when you contribute, it goes to an organization called the IETF Trust. And trust is a really important word here, right? Because when we use these standards, we want to know that we have the rights to use this document. And we're not going to get lawyers knocking at our door 5 years down the road when our product that is based on this, uses this tech, becomes wildly successful. The IETF gives you that guarantee that there aren't going to be legal repercussions further down the road. So then we get into an introduction, which tells us why do we need this? Well, we need the forwarded header when there's a proxy. And the proxy is doing load balancing or SSL offloading or caching. And there's a loss of information from the original request. So it's the why. Why does this spec exist? Goes into this part. Then we have another little standard piece. And if you use the tooling, it generates all this stuff for you. But notential conventions, words. Must, should, may. They have very precise meanings that are linked to in RFC 2119. Because when you're trying to build interoperable software, it's important to know whether something is always going to happen or it might happen sometimes. So these words have very precise meaning within IETF specifications. And characters are important too. And IETF uses this kind of funky syntax called ABNF, Augmented Backhouse NOR Form, in order. The forwarded element is forwarded pairs that are token and value separated by semicolons. It's kind of a standard thing that you'll see in a lot of header syntax. But you'll notice when it comes down to the value is a token or a quoted string. But we don't define what those are. We point to RFC 7230, which does a much more detailed job of actually explaining what token and quoted, what characters are allowed to go in token and quoted string. And you'll see this all the time when you're reading a spec. You'll go and you'll read through and it's like, oh, well, I got to go over here to find out about this. And then it'll have a link. The worst one is understanding the formatting of a date header field in HTTP. I swear you end up going through like 8 different specifications dating back to like what feels like 2000 BC. And it's like, what? And that explains why that syntax is absolutely horrible for date formats. But again, it's all backward compatibility. We don't want to break things on the web. And again, it's a hurdle initially because you can't read anything where everything is in one place. It's pointed to all over the place. The advantage is once you kind of get used to some of these commonly referred to specs, like the 2119 and the 7230, like now the spec, all that it's telling you is what's different. You already know that base of information. So it becomes a cumulative benefit over time that it gets easier and easier to read these specs, even though the syntax is a little funky. But it's easier than regex, right? So if you can do regex, you can understand this syntax, no problem. Now, many specifications don't use ABNF. They'll base it on something else, based on something like JSON. Going back to our problem, HTTP problem spec, they say right up at the top, they say, the canonical model for problem details is a JSON object. Just, it's their problem. They tell me what characters are allowed, what characters are not allowed. I'm just going to point to that. Cool. And here you go. This is the money slide, right? If you reuse that in your API, you're going to save so much time. There are libraries out there that can parse these problem payloads. You don't have to reinvent your own format for returning error messages. People can write standard libraries for displaying and parsing and logging errors. Just don't invent your own. But if you want to be on a spec, you've got to play by the rules, right? These tram lines I pulled out of JSON.org. So Douglas Crockford wrote the JSON spec, and he likes these tram lines for defining his syntax. Now, JSON, initially, back in 2006, was defined as an IETF spec, RFC 4627. And they said, well, we use ABNF. So we have to do this in ABNF. And I don't think Douglas Crockford was too happy about it, but, you know, fine. See, the thing is, when you produce an IETF spec, it eventually will get converted into 3 formats. HTML, PDF, and text. You can't render tram lines in text. You'll see if you dig into a lot of IETF specs, they'll have these wild ASCII diagrams and stuff because they needed to support text-based formats. That may change one day, but for the moment, those are the rules. So he couldn't have his tram line's in the spec. So he went to ECMA, and it's now ECMA 404 is the JSON spec. But then they changed JSON, and they said, well, you can. It's not just limited anymore to object and array at the root. You can now have a value at the root. So then IETF came up with 7159, which is JSON version, which is the revised version of 4627, but allowing you to put values at the root of a JSON. It's kind of fun sometimes following all the politics behind some of these things. And other standards bodies have other opinions. I mentioned before WatWG have a really interesting perspective on how you should define specifications. So this is a little snippet from their, it's called their MIME sniffing. So media type detection. They get a response come back and they don't really trust what the content type says. So they're actually going to look. Just part of that that says, okay, I have a MIME type, right? Application/JSON. How do you parse that application/JSON in a standardized way, that string in the media type? So they have, basically, it's code in English, where they say, let sequence be the byte sequence, blah, 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 blah. But it doesn't end there. There's another page of it. Oh, wait, there's another page of it. And then there's some more at the end of it, right? So this is an algorithmic way of parsing a MIME type. Yeah, ABNF can be handy, right? Media type, type, slash, subtype, optional white space, semicolon, optional white space, parameter, where parameter is a name value pair. It took like 5 lines to define it, right? So there's pros and cons to the different approaches to defining standards. WatWG have redefined the URL spec in this algorithmic way because they don't like the way the IETF's URI spec 3986 defines it in an ABNF way. You pick and choose your poison. We have to have a section on security, if only we could forget it. Well, we can't, right? Because we're talking about delivering information across a public open internet. So whenever we write IETF specs, we always put some kind of, these are the security considerations about using this particular spec and the technology that is described in it. So we have security considerations. And then we have IANA considerations. So IANA is kind of, the IETF falls under this parent body called the Internet Society, and IANA also falls under that. So IANA are kind of like a internet database of useful information for specs. And they have registries of things. One of the things they have is a registry of headers. And here we're, in this specification, we're saying we're registering the forwarded token into the registry so that hopefully nobody else will go off and create their own version of the forwarded header. And you can go and look at the IANA header registry, and there you go, there's forwarded appearing in the registry, and it points to RFC 7239, which is the spec for forwarded. There's also, I looked at this, Hoberreg. There's an interesting header name. It's an experimental one. It's some auth type thing. You can find all sorts of cool, interesting things. So you can register with existing registries, or you can create your own registries. In the forwarded spec, you can forward different pieces of information, the IP address, you can the host header, the protocol. And in order to allow future extensibility to this so that we can forward other information, they created and defined a registry. IANA set it up for them. And now, if you want to add additional stuff, you can make a request and say, I'd like to add another word in here. And you know, the working group will go, yeah, this is a great idea, or no, this is a silly idea for this, 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 and this reason. And if it's approved that, yeah, we can add it to the registry, it will go up to the registry. The spec doesn't have to change, right? Because we're not, so code that you're writing that works with the forwarded header doesn't have to change. Might not support the new parameter, but there will not be anything breaking. And then we get to the end of the specification, we have references, right? We have normative references and informative references. So references are, you know, the building blocks. This is how you build specs, by building on the back of other people. And normative references are the ones where you need to have a reference to this spec. You need to go and read this other spec in order to understand fully how this particular spec works. Informative are just, well, and sometimes they'll be called non-normative references. In that case, it's, well, here's some other information that has some context. We'll possibly explain why we made certain design decisions, but you don't need to necessarily refer to that in order to completely implement that specification. And of course, we end with acknowledgements, right? Because these things are not usually built by one person. People get feedback. There is consensus that's delivered, right? The second little snippet comes from the RFC 2072-30, the HTTP spec. And my name's in there because I asked a question on the HTTP working group, right? It doesn't require a massive amount of commitment to get involved. But I just didn't ask it like a show me the codes kind of question. I had a problem, I researched, I couldn't find a solution to it, and I went and asked a question on the working group, and I got an answer. But that's what it takes to get involved. So if you're following along with a particular spec that is interesting to you, has some tech, solves some problems that you have, a new version of it comes out. You'll notice they have like this version 1, version 2, version 3 in here. Well, what changed? How am I going to keep track of everything, right? Well, the nice thing is they've got diff tools. They have inline and they have side-by-side diffs. You click on this little button here and it shows you, look, this is what was removed. We update the status so we have an extra 6 months before it'll expire. We change the title. And then, look, there we go. We clarified the intention. In the HTTP problem, we include a status code in the body. And people were like, well, isn't that status code going to conflict with the status code in the header? And what if they differ? And so, like, okay. We'll write a clarification as to why we're putting that extra status code and which one takes priority and clarify it up. This is why we go through this working group consensus process. Mailing lists are where most of the conversations, yes, they do have face-to-face meetings 3 times a year, I believe, but most of the work really happens in these working group archives. It's in datatrack.ietf.org list working group, and these slides are available, so you can go dig in there, and there's lots and lots of working groups. The archives aren't exactly pretty. It's not the most up-to-date of user interface. I'm sure there's somebody somewhere working on it, but remember, a lot of it's all volunteer-based. But they are very comprehensive. You can go back to conversations about how HTTP was being built back in 1994. But sometimes digging in this way is hard, finding all this information. Sometimes you just want to search for stuff. So if you go searching just on Google or on Bing and looking for stuff, you'll get a whole ton of stuff that's not relevant. It's not from a standard. So I built this custom Google search engine, and I linked specifically to mailing lists from standards bodies and to IRC channels and draft, because WDG do a lot of their work on web browsers in IRC channels, and indexed it with Google's custom search, and you can get to it from bit.ly/standards-search. And you can filter as to, I only want stuff to be coming from official standards or stuff coming from drafts. And that makes it a lot easier to find stuff. So, as Rami mentioned, contributing is really easy. I did not know that ECMA have a GitHub repo, IETF. The HTTP Working Group have a GitHub repo. WDG have it, the World Wide Web. And if you talk to Renoir around, he'll tell you all about how to contribute to the W3C. All these organizations realize that there's a lot of value to getting more developers involved in making these kind of decisions. So it's a great time to be getting involved with this stuff. Now, creating those specs before, I said, you know, if you go to the IETF GitHub group, they've got this little make file where you can write in Markdown, and it puts it through this cram-down Ruby parser, and it generates some XML, and then it outputs the TXT, HTML, PDF. There's a little bit of YAML metadata in the Markdown, but it's dead easy to write, and it does a lot of the work for you. Really, all you have to focus on is writing the core part of the specification. And it does stuff like the referencing. All you have to do is say RFC 2119, and it builds the normative and informative references for you. Does a lot of the work. So As I say, this is a great time to be involved with writing software on the web. We have so much that we can learn from others, and we've got so much that we can teach others. So let me suggest you get involved, because the web needs you. And with that, I can always be reached on Twitter. I have a blog at bizcoder.com, and I will take any questions.